I always was troubled by sort of the great compromise, you know, of Henry Clay. And people typically have said, oh, well, that kept us from going into war, and he was a great man because he kept us from going into war. But I always thought, well, maybe he chose the wrong compromise.
Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV. I'm joined by Matt Welch of Reason Magazine, and today we're interviewing Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky. Thanks for talking with us, Senator.
Good to be with you.
You, when you came into office, you immediately dressed down Republican proposals to cut 2011 spending by $61 billion, calling instead for $500 billion in cuts. Our first question is, why are your cuts so small?
Well, that's the same question I get when I go to a tea party. Up here, everybody's like, oh, it's so dramatic. We could never do that. And when I go to a tea party event, and they'll say, well, that's only a third of 1 year's deficit. You need to cut more.
What kind of response did you get from fellow Republican legislators?
Mostly just that they couldn't comprehend it at all. If I did get any direct response, it's that they won't consider anything that has any cuts to the military in it. But I think that's what's useful in bringing it out and talking about it. One, it's useful to look at the details, because if you don't look at the details and you just simply say, oh, I'm for a balanced budget amendment, every Republican up here is for a balanced budget amendment. But as you can see, a lot of them aren't for cutting any federal spending.
Well, and then on the you've talked about it in a recent speech. You said that we can't keep doubling the defense budget, which we've done in the past few years, and expect to balance the budget. That's on the Republican side. They seem totally unwilling or incapable of really entertaining serious cuts to the defense budget to bring it back to where it was in 2000. It's not like we're right. talking about going peacetime. But then on the Democratic side, it's entitlement spending and social services.
Well, it's worse than that. It's even worse than that. On the Democratic side, the president's proposal is to take 12% of the budget, non-military discretionary spending, and freeze it at 2010 levels after he increased it by 25%. So, for example, here's how bad it is on the Democrat side. On the FAA bill, it would have been $17 billion. I introduced an amendment just to take it back to 2008 levels. Would have saved $2 billion. Not one Democrat voted for it, but all the Republicans did. So you can bring along. The Republicans are willing to be brought along, and I think many will come more in our direction. But the Democrats really aren't for cutting any spending. I mean, they said they wanted to cut the other day, what, $4 billion for the rest of the year?
Right.
That's how much we borrow in one day. We spend $10 billion in one day.
In your new book, The Tea Party Goes to Washington, you say one of the chapters is called We Don't Have a Revenue Problem. So we have a spending problem is the implication. How do we bring it back to normalcy where, you know, we're actually spending something like what we take in?
Right. It's hard because if you look at the increase, for example, George Bush's last deficit was $500 billion. And I complained. I said that was awful. That was big government Republicanism and everything I thought was wrong. And now we've tripled that.
You are a hawk within the Republican minority caucus in the Senate. What are you attempting to do with yourself? How do you approach your work in the next, you know, term, basically?
I think some of what I do is to help drive and pull the debate in the direction I think it needs to go. For example, when the Republicans originally came out in the House with $30 billion, we came out with $500 billion. Now, they didn't come to the 500, but they came and were honest to go back at least to their pledge of $100 billion. And so I think it helps to bring them around. I like to crunch the numbers, and so we put out numbers. We put out the $500 billion, and we said where we would cut it, mainly because I didn't like doing media interviews and people going, where are you going to cut? You're not really going to cut because where is it? And I do want credibility, and so we put out exactly where we'd cut the $500 billion. But it also shows you that it can be done. We did that without doing entitlement cuts. So it's amazing. There's a lot to be had there, but it only happens if you take the philosophic view that the federal government should be limited in what it does and that a lot of functions that it's accumulated over the last 70 years really should be handled by the states and the people. But I think people are ready for that. Part of the Tea Party movement was also this 10th Amendment movement. You know, stuff not enumerated should have been left to the states and the people. And so I think it is useful to talk about that, but we talk about eliminating whole departments, Department of Education, Department of Energy, Department of Commerce, HUD. We talk about sending those functions back where they should be.
How do you come up with that? Like, what is the cost-benefit analysis that you say, okay, education, it's gone. Commerce, it's gone.
Right. Well, it isn't too hard or too big a stretch to go for the Department of Education because it was part of the Republican platform from 1980 to 2000. It was one of the reasons that motivated me to run was that we were doing the opposite of getting rid of it. We were doubling it.
You know, under Bush.
Yeah, under Bush, we had No Child Left Behind, which I think doubled the employees and doubled the funding. We're up to about $100 billion. And if you look at test scores, I think test scores are fairly flat. So I don't think you can claim that we have aided education by all this federal money. Same way with like Washington, D.C., those who believe money helps education, we're now spending $20,000 per pupil, and we still have some of the worst education in the country as far as scores go in D.C. So I think there is Republican history for getting rid of the Department of Education, and there's empirical evidence that doesn't seem to be helping education.
Right after, let's talk about your relationship within the Republican Party. Right after the November election, your colleague Jim DeMint in the Senate told Fox News that, quote, you can't be a fiscal conservative and not be a social conservative. Do you agree with that?
I don't know. I think the thing is that for me, the preeminent issues are the fiscal issues, and I don't really see a relationship. I think that a lot of people who are fiscally conservative are also socially conservative. If you talk to most members of the Tea Party, I think the vast would be fiscally conservative and socially conservative. But I don't think it's necessarily a prerequisite that they're one links to the other, that you have to be both. And I think that really, for me, the most important problem facing the nation and facing the future of our country really is the debt, and that we could have a debt crisis in our country.
Do you actually think that, I mean, are we on a tipping point where it's like we go the way of Greece, we go the way of countries that just run out of money?
Argentina.
And, yeah. You know. My concern right now, and I'm actually more concerned in the last 3 days because of what's going on in Japan, I don't think things are always mathematical. I think that sometimes things happen in a panic, in a flurry. I think when the crisis came on a year and a half ago, it didn't seem to be mathematical. It was out of proportion even to the events. But the government was stoking it. The government every day was saying, panic, panic, we have to pass this or the stock market will go down. Then they didn't pass it, and lo and behold, the stock market, they talked the stock market down. But the why I'm worried about Japan is that many people have been saying that Japan has now, before this natural disaster, has passed the point of no return as far as accumulating debt. And there are smart people who look at the sovereign debt crisis and they say Japan's within 2 or 3 years of it. Well, what do you think just happened? I mean, we might have sped that up by a couple of years. They're going to have a devastating amount of money that's going to be necessary to rebuild Japan. And so I fear that being pushed up because those same people that say Japan is coming think that we're a year or two behind Japan. And I don't know if it necessarily correlates that we will move up in that scale too. But as Japan has a crisis, it will lead to panics of confidence around the world, I think.
When you won the election, your election night speech didn't mention the word Republican or Republican Party once, and nor does, I think, the title of this book. Talk a bit why you're emphasizing the Tea Party so much, and even independents, who you sort of flag as a separate beast that you're engaging with.
I've always thought the issues are more important than the party. And I think there are a lot of people out there who want somebody who believes passionately in small, limited constitutional government. People want to be left alone from the nanny state. But they aren't all Republican. Some of them are independent. Some of them are libertarian. Some of those might be Democrats as well. But I think they also don't like when you see these polls that say, oh, people don't like the rhetoric or the partisanship. What they don't like is empty partisanship. I don't think they mind you and I having a real discussion and disagreeing on an issue. They don't like us to yell necessarily, but they don't mind a good spirited discussion on both sides. But they don't like me just disliking you because you're a Democrat or a libertarian. They want me to engage on issues. And so I think that it is more important what the issues are. So people say, is the Tea Party more important than the Republican Party? I say no, but the debt problem is more important than party. And if the Republicans want to propose more big government programs like the Medicare prescription drug plan or No Child Left Behind, I'll oppose that. But that's what the Tea Party wants, and that's why the Tea Party, I think, is good, is I say that they're equal parts chastisement to both parties, because both parties have let us down on spending and debt.
All the juice in American politics, basically since TARP and the bailouts, have been in that direction. Even if it's not specifically Tea Party, it's been in the direction towards cutting the size of government, freaking out about it and reacting that way. Why is it taken so long for people who work around here to realize that?
Well, there is a disconnect, and my dad used to always say that there's a lag time, you know, maybe of years between what's going on in America and what's going on in Washington. And there's the lag time because maybe they're not truly connected to the people that well. They're not home as much as they used to be. But there's also a lag time because those in Washington are more concerned about furthering their career. And who do we see every day that comes in the office? Somebody with their hand out wanting money. Not poor people. Rich people come in here with their hand out. And corporations, special interests, lobbyists, they all want something. In fact, one of my favorite little signs or stories was there's a Michigan congressman who's elected, and he's got a sign up in his office, and it says, if you've come looking for money, you're in the wrong office. But that's what happens. So they get influenced by the wrong people, and they also are self-preservation. They want to stay here once they get here, and to stay here, they think you have to please the lobbyists. And I think the opposite may be true. See, like, they don't want to talk about Social Security. In fact, they don't want me to talk about Social Security. I'm going to anyway because
who is they? In this?
Well, let's just they
okay.
official Washington. But anyway, you know, because they don't want us out in front of the issue. They want the president to absorb some of the blow when you talk about entitlement reform. They think there will be blows. But I think even politically they've miscalculated, because I think people are hungry for someone who will step up and say, this is what's wrong and this is what I'm going to do to fix it. Look at the reaction of Chris Christie. He's nothing, if nothing else, he's frank, he's to the point, and he's unafraid to say what's wrong. And all of a sudden, people respect that. And I think even some of the media seems to be paying him some respect. So I think it's a wrong political strategy, and it's also wrong for the country just to sit back and not try to lead us out of the problems we have.
One of your, you've had a number of remarkable moments rhetorically. One was your speech where you talked about Henry Clay, the great Kentucky senator, and how he was wrong to talk about, to be the great compromiser. So what kind of response did you get from fellow Kentuckians, and what does it mean to say no compromise? Does that mean that you're a dogmatic ideologue, or does it mean that you're a man of principle?
Well, I always was troubled by sort of the great compromise, you know, of Henry Clay. And people typically have said, oh, well, that kept us from going into war, and he was a great man because he kept us from going into war. But I always thought, well, maybe he chose the wrong compromise. You know, there's nothing wrong necessarily or absolutely with compromise, but what if you choose a compromise that keeps people enslaved and owned? Is that a time when you compromise? So I think there are certain things you probably shouldn't compromise over. And I can't compare and contrast him with other people. For example, his cousin, Cassius Clay, Cassius Marcellus Clay, who was a famous abolitionist in Kentucky town, but he refused to compromise. And he was stabbed, beaten, chased through the streets. And I guess I have more respect for that. And I think if you look at history all along, politicians, because they're famous and their name is out there, get a lot of recognition. But there's a famous quote about Lincoln that I like. It's from one of the 37th Congress Republicans, the radical Republicans. And one of them said that we need to make sure in history that Lincoln doesn't live on borrowed plumage, because they were the ones fighting for emancipation, dragging Lincoln along all the way. And it was good that he finally came. And so we can say, yeah, he was a great president because he finally came to emancipation. But like when I read history in high school, my history textbook would have said William Lloyd Garrison was just a religious zealot, and he wasn't. They always had disdain somewhat for some of the abolitionists, and they were the true people who believed in things. They were true believers.
Talk a little bit about your formative intellectual and ideological background. Like where, I mean, obviously your father Ron Paul is a very powerful or very influential politician, perhaps not so powerful, but where does it come from? Do you go back and forth, it seems, between calling yourself a libertarian or a constitutional conservative? What does that mean? What's the distinction you're drawing there?
I'm a believer in very limited government limited by a document, constitutional government. Now, most people in America would say, oh, yeah, well, I believe in that, too. But it really is more specific than that, that the government only enumerated, the Constitution only enumerated certain powers for the federal Congress to be involved with. And I think whether you say that's libertarian or not, I think libertarian's become a better term than it once was, but it still scares some people, and it's used by some people to scare others, particularly in the South and different places. People use it as a weapon to try to scare people.
What do you
people.
Mean by that?
Well, I think that they're not sure what that means, what the word means. Although I would say that since the George W. Bush era, when the term conservative became somewhat meaningless, that now a lot of people, and you'll see people who probably really are more traditional conservatives saying, wanting to use the word libertarian because it's a more distinctive term. So in some ways, it has come into better usage now among the common public. But I think people understand constitutional conservative better, at least where I'm from, than they do the word libertarian. But I think they can mean somewhat the same thing.
Now, on your bookshelf behind you, I see Judge Napolitano. I see Ludwig von Mises. You're obscuring the copy of Marx back there. But who are your intellectual
Zen and the
heroes?
Art of a Motorcycle Man.
Yeah, Robert Pirsig. So we and Flannery O'Connor. This is curiouser and curiouser.
I think that I have somewhat of an eclectic background. I liked literature. I was an English minor in school and science because I went into medicine. But I was always a big fan of the short story, big fan of Dostoevsky as far as a novelist goes. But I read a lot of the free market people, and it was influenced by that. I met quite a few of them along the way. You know, I met Hans Senholtz several times. Mises only had 4 PhDs. Met Murray Rothbard through the years. So, I was exposed to a lot of them. Henry Hazlitt, we were talking about getting some books for the interns, when they come, and I thought they should all have Henry Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson and Bastiat's The Law as two things that they leave our office and had been here, they can say, this is what I got from the senator, So those are two things we're going to give them.
If the Republican Party doesn't absorb and act on the message from the Tea Party by 2012, then what? What's a logical next step?
I think circumstances will determine what happens. In a way, I think we're all being forced more and more to become fiscal conservatives or to at least address the problem. They're not addressing it because they want to. If we had an abundance of money up here right now, it'd be the same as usual. But there is a shortage of money right now. We historically brought in about 18% of GDP. We're down around 15% of GDP, but that's because we have a big recession. But part of this is a debate and a discussion about ideas, because I tell people, if you think that the Great Recession that we're in, or the worst recession since the Great Depression, if you think it was a failure of capitalism, then we need more regulations. Unfortunately, that's what most of them think up here, is that it was a failure of capitalism. So I use the word capitalism all the time. People say, oh, you shouldn't use capitalism. You should call it free enterprise or something like that. But I think capitalism is a great word. And it's, I call it democratic capitalism, because everybody says they want the right to vote. Well, heck yeah, you get to vote every day in the marketplace over which goods you choose, which businesses succeed. And it's a way of winnowing out the most efficient producers of products and goods. But I think that I'm not sure that they're quite there yet, but I think circumstances may bring us there as the debt. I really think we could face a debt crisis within 5 years.
What, judging from your recent confrontation with a Department of Energy a bureaucrat, let's say, or top official, actually, in which you ran down the mandates for compact fluorescent light bulbs and for low-flow toilets and things like that. You seem to be enjoying yourself more than any senator since Ted Kennedy about 5 minutes before Chappaquiddick. What are you doing to stay a happy warrior?
Well, I had really planned on doing that. I came in here and sat down and thought, you know what? Because I just read an article from the Competitive Enterprise Institute talking about how they're in every aspect of your house. No matter which room you walk into, they're telling you what you can buy and what you can install. And I'd read through the years all those Dave Barry editorials about the toilets, and I have the toilets. Right after they passed the law, I built my house and got the worst. They finally worked out some of the problems, but mine were installed in like 96, and they don't work. And I just get mad, that all of these things that they want to tell us they can buy, and they don't even grasp it. Because when I asked the woman, are you pro-choice? And she said, oh, in light bulbs. And it's like, that's the opposite of what she is. She doesn't want to let me choose what kind of light bulb I can buy. And I think that they're so far out of tune, they don't get it. But I think if you can bring the debate to something like that that's more interesting, if you've ever sat through one of these committee hearings, it's usually about the minutia and the detail, and that's why no one can even watch this without their eyes rolling in the back of their head on television. But hopefully on occasion I'll be able to make it interesting and talk a little bit about the underlying philosophy of should government be doing this or shouldn't government be doing this.
You gave a great talk in front of a camera about the Patriot Act reauthorization and the history of the Fourth Amendment. And as has happened a couple of times when I've watched you talk, I just had to keep reminding myself, he is a Republican. He is a Republican. It's sort of startling. What kind of response have you gotten from your Republican colleagues when you say things like this? And have any Democrats suddenly become friendlier to someone they obviously think is Hitler?
Interesting. I've learned some things from some other colleagues. And I think there's a few others that may come over to some of our reforms. They didn't vote for not extending it, but they may come for some of the amendments. We're going to offer some amendments and some reforms. And one of the things I've learned a little more about, I'm not an attorney, is about administrative subpoenas, and that, interestingly, the national security letters have less protection than an administrative subpoena, because if I serve a subpoena on you and say, I want your bank records or I want this information from you, you can call your lawyer, go to court, and try to quash it. So you have some judicial review before I do it. The NSLs, you have none of that. So the conservatives try to tell us, oh, they're just subpoenas. What's the big deal? We're just getting bank records. We've always done that. It's just a subpoena. But it's done in secret, so you don't know. And you have, and even if it weren't done in secret, if you're informed, at first you weren't even allowed to tell your attorney. Now you're allowed to tell your attorney, but I don't think you have any recourse. You can't go to a court and say, we want to stop them from doing this. We want to have a judicial hearing. It doesn't exist. And the idea of judicial review is a pretty important thing in our society. And the idea that we wouldn't have policemen or soldiers making decisions. And I don't think they're bad people. I mean, I know a lot of FBI agents. They're not bad people. They want to do what's right. But in doing what's right, they might become a little overzealous and without the restraint of having to go through a judge.
What are you optimistic, and we'll wrap up with this. You know, you're talking about a sovereign debt crisis in 5 years. You're talking about, you know, an out-of-control surveillance state, spending that is seemingly unstoppable. Are you optimistic about the future or not? You know, and at the same time, everything in American life, or many things, seem to be getting better, and then right. On this side, they're getting worse.
Well, no, I'm optimistic about the engine of capitalism, what freedom can do. I mean, we make incredible amount of prosperity and wealth in this country. I mean, almost unstoppable. But as the government gets bigger and bigger, there is probably eventually a breaking point. Also, I think, you know, there is, while we have great prosperity right now, there's also 10% of the people unemployed. There's another 5 or 10 that aren't ever getting jobs. There are whole segments of our countryside and economy where people just aren't working and they're addicted to drugs and they're just kind of sitting around collecting a check and abusing drugs, which I think sometimes go hand in hand. If you're idle, you're just laying around doing nothing. And I think so those problems exist. But I do worry about what happens if we have a significant crisis, you know, where you either, because I don't think we quit paying our debt. When you can't pay your debt, you print more money. If that accelerates, then I think you can have a destruction of your currency. The other thing is half of our currency is overseas. You know, we've been exporting our inflation forever. We import a lot of goods. We send our dollars overseas. They buy our debt, but it stays over there. And so we don't have the chasing our goods. If that ever comes back in a crisis of confidence, like in a several week period, then I think, you know, you can have chaos. But I think being here also, I don't know if we're going to have that or not. Nobody knows the future. But I think you do want to have people in place who believe in the American system of capitalism in case we have chaos. And, you know, I'd get in trouble on the campaign trail for criticism. I don't say I get in trouble. They don't send me to the principal's office. But I'd get criticism because, you know, I would talk about how when the currency was destroyed in 1923, they voted in Hitler. And everybody said, oh, you're comparing someone to Hitler. I'm not comparing anyone to Hitler. I'm just saying that in the times of crisis, even a panicky public can vote in someone who says, give me your liberty and I'll give you security. And I don't want that to happen. And so I think the best way is all these things can be gradually reformed. I mean, some libertarians give me a hard time because I'm going to try to reform Social Security rather than just privatize it. I'd love to privatize it. I'd love to have individual accounts. But the first step we're going to do is try to fix it by just letting the age gradually rise, means testing the benefits, things that aren't perfect libertarian utopias, but you got to fix, I think, some of the entitlement programs just in order not to face this budgetary crisis that's coming.
Thank you. I'm Nick Gillespie for Reason TV with Matt Welch of Reason Magazine. We want to thank Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky for taking time to talk with us today.
Thank you.